here's what you need to do. You need to pull out your outline that you were handed when you came in. You need to have a Bible. So if you're a non-Christian and didn't bring a Bible, just kidding. There's some back there. And then you also need a writing instrument. So a pen, a pencil, chalk, piece of coal, whatever it is you write with. All right, raise your hand if you have been here for at least one of the first 2 weeks of the series. Raise your hand. So you either saw it live the first week or you saw it in video the second week. So I'm sorry they made you do that. Raise your hand again. Let me just see. Raise your hand if you've been at least one of the two. Okay, so then this little test is for you. I want to do a little review because that's going to help lead us into the next 4 weeks. So we've been talking about this concept of worldview. Someone who's been here for the first 2 weeks of the series, define for me worldview. What is the definition of worldview? And don't say view of the world.
The lens through which you see the world.
Okay, there's one definition. The lens through which you see the world. Good.
Our picture of reality.
Okay, your picture of reality is actually the way better answer, because that's the answer I gave. Right. No, I'm just kidding. I just had to take an opportunity to make fun of you, dude. Yeah. All right. So, lens that you see the world through or your picture of reality. Sometimes we'll use the analogy of glasses, right? I put on glasses and it helps me to focus in terms of seeing what's around me. So a worldview is simply your picture of reality. Now, I laid out 5 key questions that any adequate worldview is going to address for human beings. Like, these are the big questions human beings have been asking for, thousands of years. So what is the first question? Go for it.
Fate or free will.
No, okay, that wouldn't be one of the 5. That actually would be one of the, on the first outline we listed 12. It would be part of those. So it would be down the line a little bit, but a very important question. Those would be worldview questions. But there are 5 that I listed that were like kind of the key, and then other questions flow from that. Okay, that was one of them, and I gave 5 categories. What category would that be under? Now, think about the first. Okay, what would be the very first category? Well, like, what is one of the most fundamental questions we ask?
I mean, I wasn't here, but I could just take a crack at it.
Yeah, take a crack at it.
What do you believe?
Okay, what do you believe about what? Yes?
I also got here, and I think it's going to become true.
Okay, there we go. You weren't here, and you even got it. The rest of you, I don't know what your problem is. Okay, here's the first question. It's the origin question. Origin. That is the first big set of questions. And that question says, or asks, where did everything come from? Right? So any worldview that's going to give you a picture of reality should give you some kind of satisfactory answer to where did everything come from? Now, last week, for those of you who were here, we talked about how this question flows right into the second question, which is the question of what? What's the second category? Yes.
Identity.
Yes, thank you. Identity. And what was it? What were the questions under identity? Yes, who are we? What are we? What am I? What does it mean to be human? This is the question our culture is asking right now, right? We talked about last week. Our culture doesn't even know what it means to be male or female. And you're living in that chaos and that confusion. And unfortunately, many of us aren't even sure how to answer that question now either. This is why this is so important. This isn't like just, oh, yeah, we're doing some academic thing over there in youth group and overflow. Man, these questions really matter. Okay, so identity. What's the third question? Third question. Yeah. Okay, good. That's good. Okay, so that would be the next question. Meaning, why am I here? What is the purpose of all this? Yeah, that's a huge question. Is there anything such thing as meaning? If there is meaning, then that means that actually has implications for the next question. What's the next question? Yes.
Morality.
Morality. And this is the question of, like, how should we live? What moral choices should I make? Is there even such a thing as a should? Or do I just get to determine whatever morals I want? And then what's the fifth question? Back to Brooke.
Death.
Death. Death. When am I going to die? No. Okay. Destiny, which would be what happens when I die. Right? Those are the five big key questions. Okay. So a little review. See, notice we've gone, I've actually talked about these for 2 weeks in a row now. And this is why we go over things maybe again and again and again so that we actually learn it and memorize it. So repetition is actually good, right? Just like if you were a football player or an athlete, what do? At practice? You repeat drills and drills and drills so that you get good at this. So we want you to get good at this. All right. So that's a little bit of review. I want to give you one last review from last week. I said origin flows into which question? Very clearly. Identity. All right. So, and the idea last week was where you come from is going to tell you a whole lot about what you are. Where we come from tells us a lot about what it means to be human. That's why the God question is so important. That's why last week I showed a video that I think I showed last year on the argument, the Kalam cosmological argument, which is an argument for God's existence, because at the end of the day, remember I talked about wanting you to not only just believe that God is real, but to know that God is real and have confidence that he's real, even on those days when you don't feel him. Okay. All right. Now, from this last week, we said identity can be broken up into two key insights from Scripture. When it comes to the Christian worldview, when it comes to Scripture, what are the two big key insights that tell us really a lot about what it means to be human? Yeah. Okay, number one, we are fallen. We are sinners. Very good. And then what's the flip side? Number two, we are beautiful. And specifically, why are we beautiful? Because we are made in God's image, right? So we're made in the image of God. So that means we are beautiful. We are dignified. We are sinners as well. We are fallen, sinful. So we're also broken. This is the paradox of being human. That we are capable of amazing, wonderful things. And we are also capable of horrible, evil things. And that's what we see played out in human history. Okay, so those are two. This is what we call theology. These are two key theological insights. And now here's what we're going to do for the next 4 weeks. We're going to take those two key insights, and we're going to really see how this stuff plays out in very important and really practical areas of your life. So today we're going to look at arts and entertainment. The following week we're going to look at money and economics. Then we're going to look at law and politics. And then we're going to look at social issues. Because what we find with most Christians is that your Christianity is like back here in this closet. It's in the background. And the times that you take it out are when you do devotions, or you go on the trek and read your Bible, or you come to church. But when you wake up tomorrow morning and head to school, here's what most Christians do, is they take their Christianity, they put it back in the closet, shut the door, and when they're doing school, when they're studying history, geography, geometry, chemistry, English, mathematics, their faith is way back there in the closet, and most Christians have no idea how it even relates to these, like, key issues.
you see. And so that's why actually I think one thing that does to you, it makes you really apathetic towards your faith. Like, hey, if my faith doesn't have anything to say about these most important issues of life, then it just creates this apathy in us, like, it's not, you're not a big deal. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to give you a Christian worldview about everything. You see what we're trying to accomplish? Okay, so what we want to do is kind of take all those puzzle pieces. So we got all these ideas and beliefs about all these areas, economics, law, entertainment. And what we're going to do is try and put the puzzle pieces together. Or as Cameron said, right, we've got this lens through which we want to see reality. And so we want to see reality as it really is. And if the Christian worldview is true, then the Christian worldview will help us to see reality as it really is. Got it? You with me? Okay. All right. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to now take the Christian worldview. We're going to take theology, our study of God, and we're going to apply it to this area of arts and entertainment. Now, let me pause here before we get into this. Let me ask you the question. How much of your life do you think is involved with arts and entertainment? A good amount? A lot? Yeah, okay. I think you're right. I think when we start looking at the role that the arts and the entertainment plays in our culture, it's massive. So let's take the highest grossing film of last year, right? Avengers Infinity War. $2 billion that movie made. $2 billion for a single movie. That means lots of people saw that. Lots of people invested in that. Does anyone know who the highest grossing musical artist is?
Justin.
No. Who'd you say? Nope. It's going to be someone you probably wouldn't even consider. Jay, it might be your era, buddy. Who? Garth Brooks? No. It's this dude right here. Bono. Bono from U2. The dude is worth, maybe I should have phrased it a little differently, but in terms of net worth, the guy's worth $700 million. $700 million. Insane. Okay? So, and then, man, so the point is, you think about the amount of money that our entertainers and our musicians make. It's crazy. Even our technology. Even our technology, I think, is concerned about art and beauty. In fact, look at this. This is a commercial for the Apple iPhone. I want you to pay attention to just the way that it's presented. Okay. If you click in the presentation, it might just start it. Oh. Did I? It's the slide. It should be the slide before that.
The iPhone 10 described our vision for the future of the smartphone. Today, we're extending that vision with significant advances across three entirely new products. iPhone XS, iPhone XS Max, and iPhone XR. iPhone XS is completely uncompromising. The expansive Super Retina display with OLED delivers vivid brightness, true blacks, and high dynamic range content. iPhone XS Max has the largest display ever on an iPhone. Custom-developed stainless steel is precisely machined to create structural bands in three finishes, including new gold. With even better water and dust resistance, this structure is integrated with the most durable glass ever developed for a smartphone. Face ID enabled
okay,
by the True Depth camera system.
I don't want to watch the whole thing. It's like 5 minutes. Okay. But the point is, do you think they're... Are they simply appealing to how well this thing functions. No, there's a visual appeal, right? There's the beauty of it. In fact, that's why Apple has become in terms of industry, I think this might be in terms of all businesses, Apple is worth more than any other business out there. They went over $1 trillion. They're worth $1 trillion. So they're worth more than Amazon or Google or Netflix or Facebook. $1 trillion. Just so you know, that's one followed by 12 zeros. And they have become huge in the market of technology, not just because they are products that work, but the products are designed to look good and to be beautiful and to be attractive. So even beauty and art plays a role in our technology, okay? So this is a huge deal. This is a huge part of our lives, arts and entertainment. Now, let me pause here. How many of you could tell me, just maybe give me some insight. So let's just have a little conversation here. What does Christianity, what does the Bible have to say about arts? What do you think? Yeah.
They're deceiving.
They're deceiving. Okay, in what way? Okay. All right. Good. Good. So they're deceiving. They draw you in and don't satisfy. Okay. Yeah. Any scripture that you might point to for that idea? So I think you're right on.
Something about remember one verse about the devil is tempting.
Okay.
It sounds good in the moment, but it's never will satisfy you.
Okay. All right. Good. Good. Yeah.
They're also good.
They're good. The Bible says the arts are good. Yeah. Where?
Because God created us in His image and God creates.
Okay. Okay, good. So what you're doing is you're drawing an inference. You're saying, hey, we have this idea, this concept, we're made in God's image. Well, what's it mean to be made in God's image? He creates. That's one aspect of it. So we, made in His image, can also create. Yeah, good. That's you're doing some theology there. That's really cool. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I was gonna say it can point us back to God if it's I forget the reference, but it's Philippians 4:8, I think, where it's whatever is good, true, noble.
Yes.
About such things.
Yes.
If art is that, then it can point us back to God.
Yes. Good, good. Actually, all three of those points are in today's talk. Good. So this is what I want you to get in the habit of doing, is thinking about life, thinking about every aspect of life through the lens of the Christian worldview, of Christian truth. Everything, whether it's posting on Instagram, whether it's riding your skateboard, whether it's doing your math homework, everything we want to relate back. How does it fit in God's world? Okay, good. So now we're going to get really explicit here. So this is where you need your outlines and your pens and something to write on, okay? Because I want you to take notes. That's going to help you when I test you next week on this, all right? So here we go. All right, I want to give you three key insights that we draw from the Christian worldview when it comes to the arts and entertainment. We are made in the image of God, Genesis 1:26. We're beautiful, we're creative. And so here's the first theological insight. Number one, it tells us, therefore, that God is the source of beauty. God is the source of objective beauty. If God is the maker of all things. So we actually, when we look, we see Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. But as you continue to read through the creation account in Genesis 1 and Genesis chapter 2, we have this very interesting point in Genesis 2. Now in Genesis 1, what does God say after each creation day? He ends by saying it is good, right? It is good. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean, like, you know, when he creates plants, they're just good nutritionally? When he makes animals, they're good for what? I mean, so what does goodness entail here? Well, Genesis 2:9 specifically talks about the look of the plants. It says in Genesis 2:9, out of the ground the Lord God caused to grow every tree. Now notice this phrase. It's just kind of hidden in there. That is pleasing to the sight and good for food. Now just pause for a second. I mean, did you think about God's attention to detail? Think about how much maybe this implies that God actually cares about us. Is that even in creating a tree, he wasn't just interested that it worked well, that it was good for food, but he also made creation in a way that was pleasing to the sight, that was beautiful. So right from the get-go, we see that God is interested in beauty. As Psalm 19:1. Psalm 19:1 says what? It says that the world that God created, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. This is this what we call a creation psalm that speaks of how this created world bears witness to this amazing God, that he's good, that he's beautiful, that he's true. Even when you look in the Old Testament, when you look in the Old Testament and you look at the instructions that God gives for the decoration of the tabernacle, God is interested in all of the little details of the tabernacle is even designed. So Exodus 26, if you read through that, it is detailed instruction. And I think a lot of us, we'd read like, you know, Exodus 26, and maybe we just kind of like check out. Oh, this is boring stuff. How does this relate to me, right? But if you step back and you read it, a second, God cared a whole lot about what the tabernacle was like, how it was designed, how beautiful it was. In 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verses 4 through 7, there's some specific instruction. He says this is about the temple. He overlaid the inside with pure gold. He paneled the main hall with juniper and covered it with fine gold and decorated it with palm tree and chain designs. He adorned the temple with precious stones, and the gold he used was gold of Parvaim. He overlaid the ceiling, beams, door frames, walls, and doors of the temple with gold, and he carved cherubim on the walls. So, I mean, this thing is covered in gold and in precious jewels. Now, was that for some, like, pragmatic function, some functional, useful thing? No, it was simply for beauty. Because the place that God was going to dwell amongst the people of Israel needed to be a beautiful place that reflected his beauty. So these are just some of the passages in Scripture that make it clear that God is interested in beauty and God is the source of beauty. All right? Now, let me ask you a question. How many of you in here have heard the phrase, beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Have you heard that phrase? Okay. All right. Now, how many of you in here would say that claim that beauty is in the eye of the beholder is false? Who would say that claim is false? Okay, nobody. One. Who would say that claim is probably true? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Okay, the majority. How many of you say, I'm not sure? Raise your hand. That's okay, too. All right, good, good. Okay, so maybe one who said beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. The majority, maybe half or so, say it is in the eye of the beholder. The rest are, I don't know. Okay. So what does it mean that beauty is in the eye of the beholder? What do we mean when we say that, we use that phrase? Yeah.
One's taste is different than someone else's in terms of what they're attracted to and what appeals to their preferences.
Okay, so you said one's taste are different from person to person in terms of their preferences. Okay, that could actually be part of this claim, that it's our tastes play a role in our beholding of beauty. Okay, yeah.
Like,
someone else just might be like, dude, what are you talking about?
Okay. So one person could create something or look at something and go, this is beautiful. Someone else could come right up and go, dude, that's ugly. Okay. All right. So there's disagreement on that. So is it, so here's the thing. If there's different tastes, if there are different perspectives, if there are different views on this, does it mean, therefore, there is no such thing as objective beauty? Is there no such thing as objective beauty? Okay, so let me ask a clarifying question here then. Let's take this question, we'll set it aside, because I think this question is a little confusing, actually. How many of you think there is objective beauty? Okay, so that's a lot more. How many of you think beauty is entirely subjective? Okay, all right, so we're split again. Okay, so here's what I want to do. I want to try and give you a couple of arguments that beauty is itself objective, but our experience of beauty includes some subjective elements. All right, so here's the first argument. Beauty is objective. And the first argument says that if beauty is an objective, then something like this, okay, who knows what this is a picture of?
It's the Sistine Chapel.
Okay, Sistine Chapel, who's the artist?
Michelangelo,
right? So viewed as one of the masters, this is one of his masterpieces, the Sistine Chapel. Now think about it. If there is zero objectivity to beauty, then there is no difference between the Sistine Chapel and this. Does anybody know what this is? This is a part of an art display called No Milk Today by Simon Fujiwara. And in order to create this series, what this artist did was he took a canvas and he placed it behind cows and waited for them to basically crap on the canvases, and then took it away, and it's now called art, and it's hanging up in an art gallery. Okay. So basically, here's the argument. It's trying to appeal to your common sense. If there is no objective beauty, there's absolutely no difference between something that Michelangelo or Monet or Da Vinci or any artist has ever painted and simply smearing crap on a canvas, right? Here would be another kind of example of this. If there is no such thing as objective beauty, then this scene of an alley with trash that's worn down, and this scene is no different than this scene or this scene. If there is no objective beauty, you could never say that one is more beautiful than the other. The only thing you could say is, I like that one more. I prefer that one. But if someone else prefers something else, then it's just as beautiful to them. Okay? So that's what you have to swallow if you want to argue there's no objective beauty. Here would be the second thing that you would have to argue. You would have to argue that there are no masters. There are no art masters. So when it comes to literature, what Shakespeare writes and what my 4-year-old or 5-year-old might write in a story or a play are, at the end of the day, they're exactly the same. Handel's music, his work in the Messiah, is no different than me taking a drumstick and just beating on the drums, okay? Michelangelo. They're actually, if art is an objective, if there's no objectivity to beauty, there's no such thing as a master, right? There's no such thing as a master. But here's the thing. What we found in Western civilization is that the vast majority of people, particularly people who study the arts, point to these people as masters. Does that just happen to be coincidence? That a bunch of people all kind of point to the same people as masters? Or is there a better explanation that there is objective beauty, we can recognize it, even if there's some ambiguity, even if there's some questions, even if there's disagreement, there's still objective beauty, and therefore we can point to those who have mastered some of the arts, have created objectively beautiful things. Okay? Let me make one more appeal here. Even today, so this is a little removed, but even in your Instagram account, I think you can recognize beauty, where you can look at someone's Instagram account and see how they've designed it, even what pictures they take, how they shoot things, and look at it and say there's a sense that this account and what is posted there is more beautiful than what other accounts do. Okay, so here would be an example, or here would be another example, where there's consideration of color and form and structure and these kinds of things that we've looked at in the arts that say, hey, these help to make something more beautiful. All right, so that would be, I think, a powerful argument that beauty at some level has to be objective. If there is no objective beauty, there's no difference between some great masterpiece and smearing crap on a canvas. They're exactly the same thing, okay? And so I think that should appeal to what we call our intuitions or our common sense. Now, you might disagree, that's okay. This is a place to disagree. Give me some pushback, give me some thoughts. What are some objections you might be kind of going through your mind? What how can we help you embrace this? Yeah. Okay, but in my argument, what's the problematic part? Because here's what I'm doing in the argument. I'm saying if somebody adopts the view that there is no objective beauty, all those details you just gave me really at the end of the day don't matter. It doesn't matter what art you kind of tools you're using. It doesn't matter how long you've done it for. It doesn't matter if you're doing it for this person or that person. At the end of the day, you have to say all art, no matter what, is exactly the same. So that's my argument, is that if you argue there's no objective beauty, all the details are irrelevant. So now, if you want to try and say, well, let's get to closer examples. Okay, just take Michelangelo's, take something like the Mona Lisa, right? Maybe considered the greatest piece of, the greatest painting, and then, cow dung on a canvas. Just take two canvases and compare those. But it really, the comparison doesn't matter, because what we're trying to do is say, at the end of the day, if there is no objective beauty, then there's no art that's better than other art. You see what I'm saying? Keep going. The way to work through this is talk through it. What are your thoughts? I'm not saying that. I'm saying the person who is arguing that there's objective beauty has to say that cow feces on a canvas is no different than the Sistine Chapel or any masterpiece, Monet, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, whatever. You can't say that their art is better than cow feces on a canvas. You see what I'm saying? So I'm actually saying we know that that's not the case. We know when we look at certain things that they are more beautiful than others. We know that the Mona Lisa is more beautiful than cow feces on a canvas. Therefore, what that tells us is that beauty is objective. So this is an argument that beauty is objective. Okay? Keep chewing on it. We'll talk more. Yeah.
I'm going to use your own argument tactics against you. What do you mean by beauty? Like, how would
Yeah. Okay. So that wouldn't actually be. So that wouldn't be an argument against this. It would just be saying, "Hey, let's clarify." And so beauty is probably a difficult concept to define. There's some concepts like beauty or like culture or, you know, things like this that it's hard to say exactly. Like you give what philosophers call necessary and sufficient conditions. We might just say beauty is the property of objects that is pleasing to the senses or something like that. That might be a very simple definition of beauty. Beauty is the property of an object that pleases the senses. Okay. Now, there's a lot more we could say about that, but that would give us maybe a starting point in terms of a definition. All right. And even in by definition, you'll see that it's objective then. It's about the properties of the object, not simply about me. Okay, yeah.
I think that part of it would have to point to the beholder's relationship with the artist as well, because I think that that's really, would really have a lot to do with what the art means to the beholder.
Okay. Yeah.
And then Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, you might actually think that Jonah's painting is a lot more special to you and a lot more important to you than Michelangelo's.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah, so that's a great point. That's a great point that has to do with meaning, but not necessarily objective beauty. So there might, I would agree, if Micah or Jonah painted me a picture, if Micah too, I mean. They both are probably on the same level at this point, right? No, you're really good with a camera, but you can't draw worth. No. Okay. So if Jonah, 7-year-old Jonah, paints something with watercolors and it's like this messy kind of thing, but it's he did it and it was a special picture for dad. Yeah, there's meaning in that because of the relationship. But at the same time, I would be able to admit that that does not reach the level of the Mona Lisa. And now, even if I did, if I said, oh, this is more beautiful than the Mona Lisa, guess what? Other people would come in and say, no, the reason you think that is you have this crazy bias. And my bias would shape my view on that. But at the end of the day, we'd still say, yeah, Mona Lisa is objectively beautiful, but this is more meaningful to me. This is more special to me than the Mona Lisa for, you know, X, Y, and Z. So, yeah. So, good point. Okay, yes.
So, if you have, like, person A and person B, and let's say, like, I think person A is more beautiful than person B, yep. Then patient thinks person B is more beautiful than person A. If, like, beauty is objective, does that mean that, like, one of us is right or wrong in thinking that?
Yeah. If beauty, if there is objectivity to beauty, then yes, we can conform to the, we can either conform more to or less than to the standard.
So then, like,
yeah, so that's the tough question. Really excellent questions, but that's the tough part about it. We're not saying that there's objective beauty, and therefore it's always easy to discern what is objectively beautiful. It's just like this is very similar to the moral argument, where we would say there's objective morality, and if someone disagrees, we would point to, okay, the fact that is it wrong to torture babies for fun? We give a clear case example. If someone says, yeah, it's wrong to torture babies for fun, or it's wrong to sell people into slavery, or it's wrong to be involved in sex trafficking, or whatever it is, if we have examples of those, are clear case examples. Now, there might be some difficult issues, right? So our views about the morality of war, can there be a just war, or is all war unjust? That's a less clear issue, but because you have less clear issues, doesn't mean that you would then go and say, hey, well, then there's no morality. In the same way, we'd say, clearly, there's objective beauty. Okay, when it comes to human beings and beauty, it's a much more difficult question to figure out, okay, what are the kind of those standards of beauty? But we, again, even in human beings, though, we would recognize that there are things that are clearly more beautiful. So, for instance, some of the like physical handicap or deformities that people struggle with. Like I just read about this guy in India who has these growths from his arm that almost look like tree bark. right? And you look at it, and it's horrendous. I mean, I you just feel such compassion for the guy. And you look at it, and it's really ugly. And what do? They try to cut it off, and not only because it's ugly, but because he can't function. But so you could look at something like that, and there's a clear case example. A regular, normal hand like this, compared to a hand with these growths all over it, clearly one is more beautiful than the other, okay? So, but there are some questions and some gray areas, okay? So, all right, let me pause. Because, and I want to keep, so for those of you who want to keep talking, let's chat afterwards. There's more that we could say on this. What I want you to do, though, is understand that there is objective beauty. And so here's a quick takeaway. So here's application. So we're doing our theological reflection. We also want to do our application. Application. You and I should look around this world, and we should look for objectively beautiful things and then enjoy them. It is okay to enjoy God's beautiful world. Whether it's some mountain vista, whether it's some amazing beach that you're on, or whether it's a meal that's been prepared that's just an amazing meal. This is where even something like for Christians, how a meal is presented. So presentation in a meal can make the meal not only taste great, but make it look beautiful. And these are things to enjoy and to take and to recognize that this is God's good world. God is the giver of food and art and beauty, and we should enjoy it. It's okay to enjoy it, all right? But as we know, there's a flip side of human nature that's going to take every one of these areas and distort it. So we are fallen and sinful, and guess what? Not only are we going to see the image of God in art and entertainment, we're going to see the fallenness of man in art and entertainment. So, well, I think one of the lies of the culture is that there is nothing that's really beautiful. It's all subjective. Because if there's nothing really beautiful, it's all just your personal taste. Guess who determines what's beautiful? We do. We do. And we replace the Creator with our own personal tastes. And this is what humanity has been doing since the start, figuring out ways to remove the Creator from his proper place and thus taking over his spot. Okay? Now, so this is where we make a distinction. There's objective beauty, but then write this down because this insight is really important here. The perception of beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The perception or experience of beauty is in the eye of the beholder. This simply means that there are subjective elements in perceiving beauty. You can be conditioned to recognize or reject beauty based on your personal tastes, your experience, okay? So there is a subjective element, but it's in how you perceive or experience beauty. And that's why this kind of explains why we can develop taste for that which is beautiful, or we can actually develop taste for that which is ugly and yet call it beautiful. Think about that for a second. That's huge. Is it possible that our culture is shaping our tastes and our preferences and causing us to desire that which is actually ugly? I think so. So let me give you an example of this. I'll pause. Shay, you got a question.
Well, I was just going to say, could that then be used with the references you gave earlier, Michelangelo and all them, as we're told they're beautiful, we're told these are things that are magnificent and therefore they're beautiful?
If you think it's all subjective, then yeah, you would say in that culture you were told this is beautiful, and so it was beautiful. In this culture now we say that's not beautiful, so it's not beautiful. That would be consistent with a subjectivist view. What we're trying to do is say that subjectivist view is wrong. There is objective beauty, but how we are shaped, our personal preferences, what we consume, will also shape our perception of beauty. So it'll have an impact on what we think is beautiful. So I'll give you some examples here, a way to kind of cash this out. our culture can, over time, develop in us taste for ugliness. So this is the warning. Okay, the warning is beware of growing tastes for ugliness and also lies. That's what you have to be aware of. So, for instance, let's take, whether you like this artist or not is beside the point, okay? Obviously, he's a big hit in the culture right now, right? Okay, so who is this? Yeah, so you guys all know. You all know Post Malone. Okay, so the argument here would be Post Malone, developing taste for Post Malone, specifically tied into the message, right? So if I were to stop here for a second, I mean, I have the lyrics to his song Rockstar, right? I have this, and you, okay, just be honest. How many of you know what the lyrics say to Rockstar? Okay, the rest of you are lying. Okay, we know what the lyrics are. The lyrics wrapped in some decent art. I mean, in terms of, you know, hip-hop, there'd be an argument to make that he's doing some good artistry in his hip-hop. But what he's also doing is he's wrapping other stuff in there, right? And he's wrapping other stuff in there that then develops in us a taste for the ugly and a taste for things that are false. I mean, read those lyrics. It's a really good exercise before you ever start putting a song on your playlist is to read lyrics before you ever start listening to the music, because the beauty and the art will sweep you up. Yeah, Chad.
Can you not read the lyrics?
I'd have to say blank, blank a lot. I mean, it would be, it starts off with A, I've been blanking hoes and popping pillies. Man, I just feel like a rock star. I, all my brothers got that gas and they always be smoking like a Rasta. Blanking with me, call up on a Uzi and show up. Man, okay, so that's just the first couple lines. Okay. Now, so here's my question. So reflect with me, because I want to reflect. Okay, I want to reflect. What in this example evokes laughter from you? So explain that to me. Like, what evokes the laughter? Yeah.
The fact that, like, how you're pointing out, like, the, like, musical qualities are, like, good to, like, listen to, like, it's pleasing to listen to. But then, like, when you just read the lyrics, like, without, like, what he's saying without the music behind them. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's kind of like an aha.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, maybe I found myself just listening to it because it's pleasing.
Yeah.
But then, okay, all right, good, yeah.
So is what you're kind of getting at, like, so, like, now in today's culture, like, that would go and people are, like, starting to, like, adapt that. But, like, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, that would not be, like, the case. That would be just, like, everyone would, like, have been, like...
Yeah, well, that would be part of one of the implications is that if you go back 50, 60, 70 years and someone put that up, we'd look at that and go, man, there's not beauty for these reasons. What can happen to a culture over time, and it's slow over time, now Post Malone is on the award shows. He's winning awards for his music. And so what's being held up as beautiful in the culture is that. And so, that'd be one of the implications. Okay. Any other thoughts on your reaction to it? Yeah.
So you're kind of saying that the good music or the good artistry in music is like a method of deception or to send a bad message or improper message.
That can be part of it. Yeah. Yes. Actually, we're getting to that. And how what we want to do as made in the image of God, how do we properly do art? Because that's what we need. Because what we don't want to just do is critique. We want to then eventually do something more than critique. So here's an example. A very specific example of how you and I are being shaped by the art and beauty of the culture, or what is considered beautiful, to develop in yourself tastes. And it's not going to be that you listen to one Post Malone song and then you're going to go do everything he did. Okay? It's that over time, what happens is our character is formed, or it's ripped away slowly but surely over time. So you continue down the path of consuming ugly art filled with lies. Make no mistake, it will shape you. It will shape you. And so this is why something like what you binge watch on Netflix, really important to consider. Because Netflix has all kinds of things that are maybe done very well from an artistic standpoint, and yet this idea of deception, something beautiful can also deceive. So we need more than just the beauty itself. But the question I want you to reflect on is, are you developing tastes for things that are false, for things that are ugly, for things that ultimately will corrupt your soul? Okay? So I think Matt gave a great verse, a reference, Philippians 4:8. So what is our instruction? Our instruction, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. If nothing else, today you take that verse, you go home, you write it on a note card, you write it somewhere and keep it a place where you will see it every day. And then you just start taking Paul's instruction in Philippians and use that to evaluate all your artistic choices. That would be a great start if you want a really practical thing to do, okay? All right. Okay, so that was theological reflection number one. Theological reflection number two. We're going to do this one a lot quicker. Image of God. We're beautiful. So God is a source of objective beauty, and that beauty points beyond itself ultimately to the source or to the beautiful one. So we look at something like Psalm 27:4. Psalm 27:4 says, "One thing I have asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life." And then this is kind of just a beautiful way that the psalmist phrases it. "To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. And that's why that last point, that last temptation is so important, because it's taking your gaze. Netflix, music, magazines, they can take your gaze off the beauty of the Lord and cause you to gaze on that which is ugly and develop a taste for it. But what we are to do is to ultimately let the art point us back to the beautiful one. And look, make no mistake, all art is pointing. All art points to something outside of itself. The question that you've got to ask is, what is this pointing at? Who is this pointing to? What is it glorifying? What is it pointing me towards? All art is pointing. Ultimately, and here's the takeaway for followers of Christ, ultimately, beauty, objective beauty, should point us back to the beautiful one. And what's the appropriate response? To gaze on his beauty and then to worship him. Art should cause us, beauty should cause us to worship. But that only makes sense if it's objective. Is God objectively beautiful? Yeah, that's why he's the source of all things. That's why there's objective beauty. Because there is an objective being, God, who exists and is the source of all beauty. Okay, so that's the takeaway. Good art, good worship. In fact, this is why, like, the band comes up, and as they lead us in worship, they practice, they don't just get up and just haphazardly go about it. They want to create music that's more beautiful, that helps us to worship before I ever got up and spoke. Okay? So beauty should lead us to the worship of God. But then, not only are we made in God's image, right? We're fallen. We're fallen creatures. And so what happens is that we end up worshiping the creators, the human creators, not the divine creator. That is really clear in our culture. Now let's just make it really practical. In what ways do you and I worship the human creators? So as we follow those human creators on social media, how is it shaping our worship, right? Because clearly, when you look at the world of celebrity and music and stars and movie actors and actresses, what they're pointing, but they're pointing back to themselves. And they're happy to receive your worship. And our culture is happy to give that worship. And you and I get involved in that. And we end up worshiping the human creators, not the creator. And this is not something that's unique to 21st century Americans. This has been going on for thousands of years. Paul talks about it in Romans 1. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Great description of today's American culture. The foolish hearts of our culture are darkened. And so that's why we celebrate evil. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal human beings and birds and animals and reptiles. So you replace the creator with the created, and you worship that. That's what fallen human beings do. This is why it's so important to realize we're made in God's image, but we're also fallen. And so we will take good things, and we will take them in the wrong direction. All right, here's the third theological insight. Made in the image of God, beautiful, creative, therefore, I hate, what's the Mac version, not PowerPoint. What's the dumb software called? Keynote. I hate Keynote. Okay. It's ugly. It's not beautiful, like PowerPoint. All right. Sorry. Okay, so image of God. Here's the third theological reflection. Okay, we're made in God's image. He is a creator. Reflecting his image means that we are also creators, or sometimes theologians will call us, we're sub-creators. There's the great creator, and think about the difference between the great creator and us. The great creator creates out of what? Out of nothing. That's the doctrine of creation ex nihilo. Fancy words that make you sound smart. That just means creation out of nothing. The greatest creator is the one who has nothing and can create out of it. That's God, the most powerful being in the universe. We are sub-creators. We don't create out of nothing. We take God's good world now, and we create out of his world. So we're sub-creators. And so we are to be creators, not just consumers. So let me play this out for you a little bit. So here's a question you need to ask yourself. Are you just swiping? Are you just swiping? Are you just consuming? Are you just consuming? Right? So whether it's food, or whether it's social media, or whether it's fashion or clothing, are you just consuming? Is most of your life consuming? Well, the evidence is clear. Our problem in our culture is overconsumption. So, for example, on your smartphones, Gen Zers, that's your demographic, spend 6 to 9 hours daily consuming media on an average of 5 different screens per day. Okay, so each day, you are spending anywhere from, on average, 6 to 9 hours consuming on a screen. Does that have an impact? Absolutely. So this is the temptation. This is the bad side of fallenness, is that we are consuming. I don't know, for whatever reason, it skipped that slide. What's the slide before this one? Yeah, okay. So the theological insight from our fallenness is that we, the temptation will simply be to consume. And there's all kinds of reasons we consume. Sometimes we consume out of greed. Sometimes we consume out of our own emptiness to try and fill our emptiness. We use consumption to distract us from the real problems we have. What we're finding in terms of depression and anxiety is that, and I think I mentioned this maybe the first week, that depression and anxiety used to be an older person's problem. Like it used to, about 29 and a half years old is when you'd first, on average, experience anxiety and depression. Now it's like 13, 14. Okay, and so now you're in this situation where you can consume, and try and keep yourself distracted. But what now we're finding in the different psychological studies is that actually the more you consume social media, it correlates with higher levels of anxiety and depression. So if you're feeling anxious and depressed, the best thing for your mental health might be to just get off social media for a while. Delete your social media, okay? Because you've been in the situation now where your sinfulness is causing you to simply consume, and it's not going to help you. It's actually going to make things worse. Okay, for sake of time, I'm going to skip a couple of slides here. I want you to, can you go to the Genesis 1:28 slide, which is like three slides up? Okay, so biblically, here's what we have. We have instruction in Genesis 1:28 to do what? God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. So, actually, one of God's instructions to humanity is to procreate, is to have families. That's a good thing. That's a wonderful, amazing thing. This is called the cultural mandate. But part of the cultural mandate, okay, come on, you can be mature about this. But then secondly, it says that we are to fill the earth and subdue it. Not only fill the earth, but then subdue it, which means to rule over creation. Rule over creation. When we consume, the created world is ruling over us. But when we create, that's part of us ruling over the created world. That is God's, that is his commands to us, that we are to rule over it. So part of ruling over it means creating, okay? And so how do we do this? Well, arts is one of the ways that we rule over the world. And that we rule over and subdue God's creation. So whatever aspect of art it could be, music, film, painting, writing, poetry, fashion, cooking, interior design, dance. And those are just examples. There's more. We could think of a lot more. You could take things like DJing or being a florist or being a home builder where you're creating things and you're actually creating beauty. Beautiful homes, beautiful arrangements, beautiful music, whatever it might be. These are all different ways that we can be creators. Okay? And so all of us in here have a place in our lives where we can be creating. Now, why aren't we creating good stuff? Is it okay if I go over a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I think this last part will help those of us in here who want to take our gifts and glorify God and do good art. This is going to, I think, maybe help us to think about this, okay? Now, you're familiar with the Christian movie that comes out, and you watch the trailer, and you're like, oh, my gosh, that looks horrible. And then you go watch the movie. You watch the movie, and it just confirms it, right? Okay, Greg Thornberry, he's the former president of King's College in New York City, a good cultural kind of thinker, solid Christian. This is what he says. I love this quote. He says, Christian is the greatest of all nouns and lamest of all adjectives. Anytime you put Christian before any art form as an adjective, it basically ruins it. When you think of art adjectivally, that is, add Jesus and stir, it's going to be a disaster. Okay? And that's really been a lot of Christians' approach to the arts. Add Jesus and stir. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, there's two kind of key aspects when it comes to art that you got to think about. You have to think about the content, but you also have to think about the form. Sometimes these are pitted against each other, content versus form. And when it comes to the content, okay, so here I'm going to give you three other categories that relate to content and form. Here they are. Number one, under content, you want to think about what's true and what's good. Are we promoting what's true in terms of the content? Are we also promoting good? So that's like when we read through the lyrics of a song, like Post Malone's song. Is he saying what's true? Because he's offering this kind of lifestyle as a lifestyle of flourishing and thriving. Is that actually true? Is it good? Is his moral vision a good vision that's going to cause us to or is it filled with lies, right? Is it filled with lies? And so that would be in the content side of things. But not only the content is put then into a form, film, music, right, poetry, whatever. So in the form, this is where you're thinking about beauty. This is where the beauty comes in, okay? Now, for a lot of Christians, here's what we've done. We have said the content is the most important thing. If I just check off the content, then we're good. It's going to be a good Christian thing because it has the truth and goodness. And of course, we do need to think about the content. But then that gives us kind of these different kind of, you know, what we call the cheesy Christian films. And so one of the trailers is going to show you is this one called Old Fashioned. Kind of a response to 50 Shades.
Mr. Walsh, the world wants to know, when are you going to kiss her? So this theory of yours, I'm curious.
I don't believe that dating trains us to be good husbands and wives. Trains us to be skilled in the superficial.
Who talks like that?
I do.
Shoot the ball. Fact, most people know more about someone after a job interview for delivering pizzas than they do after most dates.
Where do you get this stuff from?
Why don't you just crawl back onto that cute little antique shop and make up some more theories you never test out at the grown-up table anymore?
I rented the upstairs to a girl.
Is she a pretty girl?
Not my type.
How do you know? So help me, man.
How come you haven't asked me out yet?
If I do, you stop breaking things? Okay. I needed to believe my life could be different than it was. That I could be different.
And how did you do that? And don't even tell me you found Jesus or something.
More like he found me.
Really?
You just packed everything you own into your car and started driving until you ran out of gas.
Make a fresh start. Go where the wind takes me. Follow the warm and fuzzies.
Life just isn't all warm fuzzies.
It's not just all rules either.
If you don't chase after that girl, you're nowhere near the person we thought you were.
All I want is for you to tell me how I make you feel. How do I make you feel, Clay?
When did treating women with respect become the joke?
You want to know what the joke is?
I came here ready to forgive you no matter what.
You make it sound so easy.
You make it sound impossible. Again.
Yourself, you and your pain. Stop using the grace of God as a brick wall.
Okay, now listen. This is actually not one of the worst examples in terms of cheesiness. But what I wanted you to see on this, what I wanted you to see on this is that a lot of our Christian movies come off as very, very preachy. Like, right, this is, I think there's an overly preachiness about this. And I think that's because we focus only on the content, right? We just focus on the truth and goodness. And we should focus on this. And it doesn't mean that the people who didn't make this aren't good-hearted people. And it doesn't mean God can't use something like this to have an impact on some people, okay? But unfortunately, I think what's happened is that we simply focus on that content part and don't give much thought to the beauty part. And so then when we make movies, they only play for us. Like, this is going to appeal maybe to the Christian. And the Christians who are often more gracious are going to let other Christians get away with it. Be like, well, they're good-hearted. It's got a good message. It's cheesy, so what? Right, and we'll be gracious about that. But I think we want to do better than that. I don't know if you know, how many of you are familiar with Lecrae? Okay, Lecrae is a Christian artist. He's actually had a lot of what we call mainstream success. But this is what he says. He says, we've limited Christianity to salvation and sanctification. Now, are those important? Obviously, absolutely. He's not saying they're not important. But we've limited Christianity to salvation and sanctification. Christianity is the truth about everything. That's the Christian worldview, right? Christianity is the truth about everything. If you say you have a Christian worldview, that means you see the world through that lens. Not just how people get saved and what to stay away from. Christians need to embrace that there need to be believers talking about love and social issues and all other aspects of life. All right? And so as an artist, what you want to do is you want to take the content, you want to take the truth and goodness, and you want to put it together with the form, which is beauty. So Christian artists, whether you're making music or film or poetry or even in your Instagram account, I'm not kidding. Think about, I don't know why it jumped forward. Go, can you take that back? There we go. So what we want to do to make good art as followers of Jesus is to check off the box on content and beauty. And if I were to say, hey, here are the three categories for our art, it's truth, goodness, and beauty. Truth, goodness, and beauty. That's what we want to do. And when we do that, we'll make way better art. Now, I wanted to give you an example of this. An example would be something like Pixar, okay? Pixar, where you have even non-believers. Now, this is cool about the image of God. The image of God is not just in you if you believe. The image of God is in unbelievers. That's why we can recognize when an unbeliever does good art, okay? And so the artists at Pixar do amazing art, don't they? In fact, there's a really cool book on this. It's called The Wisdom of Pixar, an animated look at virtue. And of course, I think one of a great example. So if I were to kind of in contrast to the cheesy Christian stuff we put out, you look at an example like Up. The first 4 minutes of that movie are true and good and beautiful. Right? And whereas I could be very preachy and say, God's design is for a man and a woman to come together in marriage and to be committed to each other and faithful for the rest of their lives. I can say that, and that's true. What the beginning of Up does is it illustrates, it paints the picture, doesn't it? Do I have time to show it or no?
Yeah,
are you sure?
Yeah, ask Hannah.
Hannah.
Right there.
Oh, there, Hannah.
Your worship
Is it okay if I cut into worship? Okay.
Yeah.
And we might cut out worship. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Sorry. All right. I'm stoked because you guys, from the first 2 weeks, you guys you're talking, you're engaged. Well, actually, I don't know what happened last week, but because I was here on video. But you're engaged, so I'm stoked. Okay, all right, so let's just, I think one of the great ways to learn this is to see it. So that's why I gave you the example of the Christian kind of dating movie, right? Well, here's Up, and Up We'll send a message. This artwork is pointing to something else, but just look at the way that it does it. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, do you see, now do you see what I mean about bringing content and form together? Because the content is true and good. But then the form, notice what the form does to us. Notice how it evoked the emotion. I mean, I'm sitting up here saying to myself, don't lose it, Brett, you know? Very different than a kind of a cheesy film that doesn't, the beauty of it, the form of it doesn't evoke that emotion, right? But here you have truth, goodness brought together with beauty, and it's powerful. That's, as creators, that's what we want to do. We want to bring together truth, goodness, and beauty. In fact, Martin Luther, who was a great theologian, put it this way. This is a kind of one of those anecdotal stories. Not sure if it's totally true, but it's brilliant. Where he's responding to a cobbler or a shoemaker about how he can be a good Christian and be a cobbler. And Luther says the Christian shoemaker does his duty not by putting little crosses on the shoes, but by making good shoes, because God is interested in good craftsmanship. God is interested in the art we make. So here's the takeaway for you and for me. You and I need to make sure that we're doing more making than taking. That we're doing more creating than consuming. We were made in the image of God to create, to make beautiful things, and then to give them back to the world. And when we do that, we then can proclaim the gospel and the goodness of Christ in all kinds of different ways that are beautiful, that God's Spirit can use to bring people to Him, okay? And that, our organization, notice we're very purposeful in our mission. The mission of Maven is to know truth, pursue goodness, create beauty, to take all of God's truth, apply it to all of life, all right? And so, we'll close with this. This is our prayer. In all of our making, in all of our doing, in all of our creating, we can do this. So it doesn't matter if you're a cook, a chef, a social media celebrity, a musician, a bricklayer, whatever. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. And when we make beautiful things, we can do that for the glory of God. Amen. Amen.